I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. When I was coming up in the acting profession, there were two teachers you had to take classes from. Milton Katselis in Los Angeles and Wynne Handman in New York. I studied with both, and both contributed to my technique, but Handman also influenced my approach to life and to my co-workers on screen and on stage. His goodness, kindness, and generosity shone through in a professional world too often characterized by cutthroat competition and one-upmanship. Over the years, an astonishing array of talent passed through Handman's studio. Christopher Walken, Raul Julia, Richard Gere, Anna Deavere Smith, Joanne Woodward, Mia Farrow, and on and on. But after 70 years, yes, 70, enrollment is finally closed. In April, Handman became one of New York's victims lost to COVID-19. I was finally able to get him to record an interview for Here's the Thing in 2018, and I'm bringing you our conversation today. I witnessed as Wynne made real progress with some marginally talented actors, but he remained humble about what teachers can do.
If they don't have the right stuff inside them, I can't do it.
So there's a basic thing they need.
Yeah. The basic thing is actors are highly suggestible people. If I suggest something to you, you'll go with it. We're too gullible for everyday life. So one of the things they have to draw upon is their ability to be suggestible. Because what is it? You're suggesting something to yourself so you inhabit the reality in an imaginary situation. And if you can do that, then you can take people on the journey. I have recently noted people I took who had no background and not that much going, and now they're doing Shakespeare and the Greeks. And I said, hey, that's good. And I recently said to one, I said, you know, I've been congratulating myself because where I've taken you in your acting. Yes, the tremendous improvements can be made.
Well, it's interesting to me when I'm with my children, you see the actor's nature.
They want to believe. See, that's what Sandy Meisner, way back, Sandy was my mentor. And he would say, it's like when you played Cops and Robbers or when you played House when you were a kid. Get that back, that naive innocence of believing.
Where did you meet Meisner? And tell people who Meisner was then.
He was a member of the Group Theater. And the Group Theater embraced the Stanislavski system, and they trained with that. But Sandy was best known for teaching at the Neighborhood Playhouse School of the Theater. And he had been teaching there maybe from the late 30s. I got to him in 46 as a returning GI. I had been in the service 4 years, so I had the wonderful GI Bill. I wanted to say that's one of the best things that America produced was the GI Bill. I went there under the GI Bill. And when I got there, I had no experience whatsoever. I had only seen a few plays.
You discovered the theater yourself in Boston when you came home from the war?
I saw Paul Robeson in Othello with Uta Hagen and Jose Ferrer. Mm. I was just on leave, and it was maybe about the fourth play I had seen in my life. When I was in the service, I was there for 4 years. I had been a jazz musician, but I realized I was at
best. You played the saxophone.
Yes, second rate. I wouldn't. That wasn't going to make that my profession, and I absolutely did not know what to do. And I was on the ship waiting for it to be decommissioned. Then I faced the reality that I should have a future. What am I going to do? And I decided to try acting. I had never acted. I had nice experiences.
But whose idea was that?
Mine, because I had good experiences I didn't do many things that my father felt I did well. But when I did, you may talk of gin and beer when you're quartered safe out here, and you're sent to penny fights and all to shot it, then you'll do your work on etc. or the face on. When I did those poems for him, he liked it a lot.
And so, he was your first audience.
And I got a good response.
What'd your dad do?
He had a printing business.
You grew up in Inwood.
Yeah. I lived on a dirt road in an apartment house. You know where Fort Triumph Park is?
Of course.
It was right across the street from what became Fort Triumph Park. But when I was a child, it was woods. And we had a dirt road, and it was a farm across the way. A farm with chickens and all kinds of things. When the Depression came along, the farm left, the dirt road got paved, and it became a miniature golf course. And I was a caddy in a miniature golf course.
What does a caddy do in a miniature?
I kept the score. But anyway, when I was on a ship, it was a North Atlantic anti-submarine duty, escorting convoys up to Northeast Greenland. You spent a lot of time in the wardroom with your shipmates. They play cards, things to do while you're not on watch. And we had some records on the ship that were of monologists. In those days, they were called...
Sure, yes. Know,
the people who performed in nightclubs, and they was usually a little bawdy. And there was one that I was particularly attracted to. His name was Dwight Fisk. And he had been performing at the Monkey Bar at the Elysee Hotel.
What hotel?
The Elysee, where Tennessee Williams died.
Right. Oh, wow. Okay.
Anyway, I memorized the monologues. I listened to the records, and I did them for my shipmates, and they liked it. And I like getting laughs, and this is a sure
so
laugh.
So when you were in the military, when you were in the Navy.
Well, it was the Coast Guard under the Navy.
So you're there, and with the guys there during the war, you're cracking them up and entertaining them.
Yeah.
What kind of material did Fisk do?
Bawdy songs. Yes. Here's one line from it. And out stepped Mr. Pettibone, just as naked as a child and twice as cocky. You would have liked to have done that monologue. Anyway, that encouraged me. So when I was waiting to get out... they could be turned to civilian life. I said, what I enjoyed was when my shipmates, and they enjoyed my doing those monologues, and when my father liked it when I did Gunga Din. Why don't I try acting? That's the only thing.
How did it go? You tried it, and what happened?
I went to I didn't know one school. I didn't know anything. There was a guy on the ship with me who seemed sophisticated, and while we were waiting for the ship to be decommissioned in Norfolk, Virginia, and I said to him, I want to try acting when I get out. I have the GI Bill. I can go to school. He said, well, there's only one school to go to. And I said, what's that? He said, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. So as soon as I got out in May 46, I went to the American Academy. You know where it was?
Where?
It had two floors on the top of Carnegie Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we have too many returning GIs. You can't apply. I said, I can't even apply? No. You do monologues. So I saw the pack of monologues, and I learned it, but they never let me do my audition monologue. So I was disconsolate because I didn't know of any other school.
So you didn't audition for the American Academy?
No.
Where'd you go then?
Well, I was dating a woman. I believe her name was Doris. Well, I said, you know, I can't even apply at the American Academy. I want to try acting. She said, well, go try the Neighborhood Playhouse. I hear that's the best school.
And that's the first acting school you attended?
The first and only. And what happened was Sandy interviewed me and took me. I think he took me because I talked about improvisation, because I did it as a saxophonist. But also I had written one poem when I was on the ship waiting to get out. And I think that impressed him. Here's the short poem. Home now, feeling the years of war-spent youth, not time apart, nor interlude furiously lived, forgotten now, like motion picture with yawning exit to routine. I knew I didn't want the yawning exit to routine, so I wanted to try acting. So I got into the Playhouse. I immediately caught on.
How many people are in the program when you're there? You walk into a classroom, how many are there?
Oh, there are about 20, 25.
Like it is now. There's a couple, like maybe a couple dozen or
yeah.
less.
And inside of 2 weeks, because Sandy saw I was catching on, and a lot of them didn't, to what he was trying to get at, he said, you work with her. You work with him. He had no patience with them. I had such an affinity for what was going on that it was the first time in my life I felt this is what I can do.
Which is to teach.
Teach, direct, yeah, work with acting.
You no longer want to be an actor. You want to be an acting teacher. Does that happen quickly?
No, I wanted to be an actor.
And how much acting did you do?
Not that much, because I moved into directing. Sandy was like my guardian angel.
Sure. Very smart guy.
He latched on to me. I was assisting him at the end of the first year. He was doing a play called Truckline Cafe,
right.
which had been—
Brando.
Yeah, Brando was successful on Broadway.
Right.
And so that was the second year class's graduation, and there was an eight-year-old child in it. He had no patience to work with that eight-year-old child. He said, you work with her.
Right.
It turned out to be someone whose name was Susan Plachette.
Oh, my goodness, my goodness. Now, when you're there, well, you look back now,
yeah.
and you've been teaching for quite a long time.
Yeah,
you've been teaching for eons.
Since Sandy started me in 1950.
Okay, so you've been teaching for since the Stagecoach years.
Without a stop.
Right, and so and with that in mind, can you look back now from your perspective and say, what were Meisner's strengths and weaknesses as a teacher?
Well, he was enormously perceptive. And could pick out what you weren't doing and what kind of suggests what you should be doing, and expressing it in ways that you could hold on to, like he'd say, everything prepared but the acting, or as ifs, you know, metaphors. He had good ways of suggesting that. His criticism sometimes could be cutting.
He was direct.
Too direct.
Right. That's what I meant.
When he was going to... See, I had been a naval officer and on a ship. If it was going to ram and hit something, stand by for a ram. Well, Sandy would put his glasses on his forehead, and I would say, stand by for a ram.
I'm going to use that.
When he did that, it was bad. Because
he didn't suffer
fools. You don't get over that fast.
Right.
And criticism at that level. You see, it's a tremendous responsibility to be an acting teacher, because you can say one thing that could damage someone for life.
Yeah.
It's so precarious.
And that, by the way, I want to interject for my listeners here. I mean, why I was so keen on doing this with you was because that nurturing and that kindness, your reputation in New York when I first came here was you were a very supportive and kind and nurturing teacher.
The late director and teaching legend, Wynn Hempman. More coming up. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Wynn Hempman shares with his mentor, Sanford Meisner, the move away from so-called effective memory. That's the method acting staple of summoning one's own emotional experiences in order to channel the character's trauma or joy. But Hempman's warm embrace of his students stood in sharp contrast to the man who first gave him his shot.
It's not in my nature to hurt people, and it's in my nature to bring people along and know how vulnerable they are. See, when Sandy says, you will become my assistant and you will have an apprenticeship of humility. He said that directly. And he said, you will watch every one of my classes and do your own. And I did that. So I saw more Sanford Meisner classes than anyone because he ordered me to do it. And I thank him for it because I learned from it. But I could see where he set people back because of the tension, and I felt it. I mean,
why do you think he did that? Did he believe that was in their interest?
He had that nature. He could be very mean and nasty.
And abrasive to people, yeah. So Meisner was known, obviously, in a very kind of a basic sense, for this repetition technique, the Meisnerian thing. Did you not see that present?
No, that wasn't done then.
It wasn't.
He didn't do it. And I know why he developed it.
Why?
Because it was the period of naturalism and, you know, strong realism, living off the other person. What the repetition does is it makes you go off the other person. Fuck you. Well, I said fuck you. You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But then they became his whole system, his whole method, which is absolutely ridiculous.
Did you think that's true, that did become his whole system?
Aren't there teachers around who, they teach Meisner.
And that's
it. And so what do you do? Well, you do repetition.
That's Meisner.
Yeah, how long can you do repetition exercise? Maybe a week or something? No, the whole semester. Well, I think it's for teachers who don't have the chops to really teach. So they watch these people go back and forth with their repetition.
Yeah.
Well, Sandy was everything to me. He trained me.
Yeah.
And he moved me right along. He could be very tender. So when my first child, Laura, was born, he gave her a little thing from Tiffany, a pearl. And every birthday, he gave her another pearl. And I said he's our godfather. And he got me started directing because there was up in the Adirondacks, there was a leftist adult camp.
A leftist adult camp?
It was very political.
What are you saying? It was political.
He said, you should direct that company. I was not married yet, but my wife-to-be was a truly great woman. Anyway, I sat on a bench with her up at Columbia University where she was at Barnard. I said, Sandy wants me to direct. I'm not. She says, do it.
Yeah.
And when Bobby Bobby, that was so right for me. I had my own company. I did play after play, and I knew I was a director.
Now, what do you think Lee's strength was? Or were you critical of him?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Lee Strasberg.
Okay, that's okay.
First of all,
a lot of people weren't.
His speaking gave me a headache.
Right.
Here's an example. I had a student who took his directing course, and he used two of my students. One of them was Dallas from North Carolina, and another woman from Jackson, Mississippi. They did a scene, and he was very critical. So he had them do what he had, his emotion memory, and they did it, and he was very pleased. But she said to him, yeah, but Dallas was in North Carolina, and I was in Mississippi. He didn't transfer into saying, well, whatever you're getting from that, now move it into where
scene.
You are now.
Yeah.
One of the things you learn in basic acting, and acting is doing, because you have an intention, a purpose, because out of your want. Well, they got so preoccupied with physical things like itches and pains and
behavior
that they lost the intention. And that was no good. I was critical of that, but he let that go.
Well, there are people who do scene work in classes. It could be scene work at the Actor's Studio, which isn't really scene work. It's more like previous circumstances or prior circumstances.
Yeah.
They do a lot of different kind of exercises there. For those who don't know what I mean, you take a scene from Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and let's go back and do the scene that happened a couple of days before that we make up and we improvise what are known as the prior circumstances, and we improvise that. But these exercises, which is really the bread and butter of the studio.
Inhabiting the character.
Right.
If you get in the character, then the character does the work for you.
Right. It's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, well, that's training. Right. So I've developed something called a character interview. So if you're working on the role, I say, well, before you come back in, put down four questions you want to be asked about yourself.
What are they?
Oh, well, they make them up for their own.
Oh.
But then I know what the material is.
I thought you were
about
to give me the secret to great acting.
See,
again.
I know what the material is about.
Right.
So then I have my own questions in mind. And I don't let them do the scene, but I only get them improvising in this character that we're developing. So then when they get to the scene, the character is inside. Right. People remember it when it's inhabited.
When do things end with Meisner? You're done with Meisner. You guys part ways when?
55.
And then between 55 and 63.
I'll tell you exactly what happened.
Okay.
He taught, first year was basic acting. Now, basic acting is important, but it got boring to me. And I was teaching more basic acting courses than he was. So when the new season began and I saw the schedule, I said, hey, I can't do this much basic acting anymore. It's like mountains ahead of me. I just can't take it. So he flew up, he got very angry, and I got angry, and I left. I had a certain independence, which he gave me.
Right.
Because I immediately got
You were ready to fly the coop.
Sure.
Between 55 and when you open American Place, what do? You start teaching privately?
No, I was teaching classes. I was teaching four classes, each with 20 or more people.
Where?
I had my own studio
on
West 56th Street.
What was it called?
Just the Win Hanman Studio.
When did you start American Place Theater?
I started it in the early 60s, 63.
Why did you want to start a theater?
Because it wasn't enough for me to teach. I was reaching, I guess it was midlife crisis. What am I going to do with my life? I'm teaching very well and I like doing it and I can do it. But is there more I can be doing? Well, what was in the air at the time was not to just do Broadway kind of theater, but to do others. So Bruce Stein had an article about that, you know, Robert Bruce Stein, the critic. And there was an article called The Plight of the Serious Play, which I saw in the New York Times. And quotes from George Bernard Shaw, which I'll do one, which meant a lot to me, and I'd like to record it. You see, George Bernard Shaw was a theater critic in the 1890s, and he for 3 years. And when he finished with that, he started writing plays. But they published all of his criticism in the collection called Our Theater in the 90s. He said this: more people went to the theater in London when I was reviewing than went to church. This would be a very good thing if the theater took itself seriously as a factory of thought, an elucidator of social conduct, an armory against despair and dullness, and a temple of the ascent of man. Well, I carried that around. I said, this is what I have to fulfill.
Right.
So it got me started looking for plays that were that. He also, in one of his reviews, said something very meaningful to me. He said, well, this play's an entertainment. Nothing wrong with that. Not a serious revelation of mankind to itself. That's what we're really about.
Yeah. Give us two examples, male, female, who came through your doors, who you just excited you. You knew they had it. They went on to become great actors.
Michael Douglas, he said, you asked me if it was all right if I could call your mother and tell her how good you are. I knew his mother.
Right. And he was good.
Yes,
he was good.
He was very good right
now. What
off.
About a woman? What's an actress who came through your doors?
Allison Janney.
Right.
Allison Janney.
Incredibly talented woman.
Yeah, you just give her a role and
she can do it all. She can do it all.
Right.
Now,
and I should mention one you never heard of. Her name is Mary Alice Bye. And I directed her in a summer theater up in the Borscht Belt area in the 50s. And I just couldn't get over her talent. With one word, this actress was a summer stock play, four-poster, The Evolution of a Marriage. And then there's one sequence where the man has gone off and been with another woman. Now he came back. She loved that man. All she said was, "You?" And that "you" is still with me. It just bounced off every wall of every theater because she had so much going down here for her love for this man, Mary Alice.
Right.
Now, I caught Laurence Olivier at a performance of The Entertainer, which it was on a Thursday, and David Merrick.
In New York.
In New York. And the word was out, well, he missed his performance. He wasn't as good as he had been in England on the opening night on Wednesday. Well, Merrick wanted to get eight performances in, so he had a Thursday matinee. And he had to fill the theater, so it was all actors. And when Olivier walked on stage, they applauded and greeted him. And from that entrance on, he was so in that character. He's never been in a character like that. That was absolutely memorable. And not just one moment, but memorable. But there are moments like when I saw the original Streetcar, when Marlon was hearing the sisters talk about how an animal, Blanche was saying he's an animal.
Don't hold back with the apes,
yeah,
she
don't
says.
Hold, he was out there listening. You got so much from him that you see it's still in the air.
Pig, Pollock, disgusting, vulgar, greasy. Them words have been on your lips and your sister's too much around here. Remember what Huey Long said, every man is a king. And I am the king around here. And I smashed my hand. I go backstage, all my knuckle was all bleeding. But I didn't give a shit. I was so happy.
I remember how good you were.
Your class, I always remember, because you were so encouraging. I mean, but we got into it. You mean you had that freedom to just explore each other emotionally, you know, and that love, you know, which you just can't fake on stage. When I teach now, I say, do yourself a favor. I say, really luxuriate in this now, this process. Because when you get older and you go to work, it's all Arthur Murray. It's all steps on the floor and you go
here, Murray
and turn.
Taught me dancing in a hurry. I had a week to spare. He showed me the groundwork, the walking around work, told me to take it from there, et cetera.
You know something? We're going to end with that. We're going to end with your Arthur Murray song.
Well, thank you.
Right.
And I'm very glad we met.
Wynn Handman, founder of the American Place Theater, mentor to thousands, father to Laura and Liza, husband to the late Bobby Handman, and a force for good in the world of acting and beyond. Rest in peace, Wynn. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.